Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Kevin McCarthy's continued attempt to become Speaker of the House continues at this hour. The House is expected to take another vote late tonight. You'll see it live here on Fox, of course. But first, an anniversary. 2 years ago today, a Capitol Hill police officer called Michael Byrd shot an unarmed woman in the neck. At the time of that killing, Byrd had a documented history of gross negligence with a firearm. He left a loaded Glock pistol in a public men's room at the Capitol, which for a law enforcement official is a firing offense. But for some reason, Michael Byrd was still in the force that day. The woman he killed was called Ashley Babbitt. Babbitt was a married 14-year veteran of the U.S. military. She ran a pool cleaning company with her husband in San Diego. Physically, she was tiny. She was also unarmed. Michael Byrd later admitted he had no indication at all that Babbitt was carrying a weapon. She posed no visible threat. He killed her anyway. Under normal circumstances, Byrd would have been fired immediately and charged with murder, which he clearly committed. But that's not what happened. After doing essentially no investigation into the shooting, Nancy Pelosi's Congressional Police Force declared Byrd a national hero, and the media strongly agreed. Byrd went on television to accept accolades and to complain about racism. He was never punished for killing Ashley Babbitt. He was rewarded for it. Ashley Babbitt's mother, meanwhile, got a very different sort of treatment. Babbitt's mother was arrested today in Washington by the Capitol Police. Her crime? Trying to hold a memorial service for her daughter. 2 years later, it's clear that Ashley Babbitt is, her death is by far the most significant thing that happened at the U.S. Capitol building that day. But at the same time, it is the least talked about event of January 6th. Why is that? Well, because the facts about what actually happened on January 6th disrupt the lies, what they've told you happened on January 6th. And those lies have proven very useful to the Biden administration and to permanent Washington. On the basis of a wholly created myth about what happened that day, the Biden Pentagon conducted an unprecedented political purge of the entire U.S. military. The FBI and various intel agencies increased their control over the American media. And most obviously, the DOJ has been allowed to prosecute and jail hundreds of nonviolent political protesters whose crime was having the wrong opinions. Lies about January 6th, which have been relentless, have enabled some of the most unscrupulous people in our country to make a mockery of our Bill of Rights and to steal our core freedoms. So they can't talk about Ashley Babbitt. Talking about Ashley Babbitt makes it very clear who the real culprits are and who the real threats to this country continue to be. And they're not the January 6th protesters. So instead, they lie about what happened that day, and they do it in the boldest possible ways, without shame and with maximum aggression. Here's Hakeem Jeffries, leader of the Democrats in the House, telling you that five police officers were killed on January 6th, when in fact the real total is zero.
We are gathered here to honor their memory and acknowledge with deep gratitude the tremendous bravery of the hundreds of officers who defended us at this citadel of democracy that fateful day. As a result of the events on January 6th, the lives of five heroic officers were lost.
Five heroic officers were lost, he said. It's almost impossible to believe that adults could stand behind him as he said that, because everyone in the picture you just saw knows that is not true. It's not a stilted interpretation of events. It's a flat-out lie. No police officers were killed on January 6th, period. Ashley Babbitt was killed on January 6th. But chances are your grandchildren will not know that, because history will likely record the lie you just heard as true, simply because it's been repeated so often. Everyone in authority has said the same thing in unison for two solid years. As our thoroughly dishonest attorney general recently put it, quote, we will never forget the five officers who responded selflessly on January 6th and who have since lost their lives. His boss, Joe Biden, repeated that lie today from the White House.
These people and the people representing those who couldn't be here because they gave their lives for this did is incredibly consequential. And that's not political talk, that's historical fact.
That's historical fact, says Joe Biden, as he manufactures history, as he tells lies. They've been doing this, telling these same lies, since the very first day, January 6th, 2021. Almost like it was a coordinated operation. Remember when they told you that Officer Brian Sicknick was beaten to death with a fire extinguisher?
Officer Sicknick died after being hit in the head with a fire extinguisher.
Sicknick died after being hit in the head with a fire extinguisher.
Officer Brian Sicknick died after being hit in the head with a fire extinguisher during the hours-long attack.
They beat a Capitol Police officer to death with a fire extinguisher.
Officer Brian Sicknick died after being hit in the head with a fire extinguisher during the fight.
He died at the age of 42 after he was bludgeoned with a fire extinguisher.
That's not true. And in the end, thanks to the medical examiner in the District of Columbia, we learned the fact, which is that Brian Sicknick died of a stroke well after the January 6th protests. He was not beaten to death with a fire extinguisher. But that did not stop their lying or even slow them down. Joe Biden just awarded one of this country's highest civilian honors, the Presidential Citizens Medal, to officers working on January 6th. And that would include the officers who opened the doors of the Capitol building to the so-called insurrectionists. The officers who let them inside and then were rewarded for it by the President of the United States. What's going on here, you may wonder? Well, don't ask. You're not allowed to know what's going on here. Nor can you know about the very obvious clandestine role of federal agencies that encouraged the events of January 6th. That happened, but its details have never been explained. A lot has still not been explained from that day, despite a committee that was impaneled for more than a year. For example, you remember the pipe bomber who planted explosives outside the Democratic National Committee? Well, those explosives, it turns out, were under a bench at the same moment that Kamala Harris, who had Secret Service protection with her, who swept the building, was there. So how did the U.S. Secret Service miss a bomb sitting in plain sight during its security sweep? Well, we can't answer that because the FBI still, to this day, refuses to release all the security footage. Why? What's going on here? Almost unique among media outlets, Revolver News asked that question.
The pipe bomber even looks at camera to head on, for some reason. It's very frustrating, because we can't see the moment the pipe bomber plants the pipe bomb, but the FBI can. That's because the whole scene should be captured on camera one as well, and much more clearly than camera two. Camera one has a clear shot of both benches. If the FBI released the full tape from camera one, we could see the pipe bomber planting the bomb.
So somebody planted bombs outside the headquarters of this country's two main political parties. That would seem to be a big story, and yet no one ever mentions it again, including the FBI. In fact, the Bureau won't disclose any information about the suspect, not his height, weight, shoe size, anything. So if they wanted to catch this person, wouldn't they be telling you all they can about who it is? But they're not. Why aren't they? And what was Kamala Harris doing there? Why did she lie about being there? We can't answer those questions. We should be able to. Nor does anyone in authority want to talk about Ray Epps. Ray Epps, of course, is the man who was caught on tape encouraging the crowd outside the Capitol, both on January 5th and 6th, to commit felonies by rushing inside. Now, what's interesting is that the January 6th committee, under public pressure, did in the end interview Ray Epps. Now, we don't have all of the committee's records about that interview. We should, but we don't. But some have been released, and what they tell is a remarkable story. In the testimony that we have, the committee coaches Ray Epps on how to answer questions about his involvement. Quote, "I was in the front with a few others. I also orchestrated it. I helped get people there." End quote. Now, Epps admitted that in a text message to a relative on January 6th. He's admitting crimes. He's never been even charged for those crimes. But what's so fascinating is that when those facts came up in his interview with the committee, someone on the committee responds this way, and we're quoting, "I just want to understand a little more your use of the word orchestrated. It sounds to me like at this point, when you sent this text, you had turned away in part because of seeing some things that you didn't agree with. Is that right? Like when you sent this, you were already on your way from the Capitol because of concerns of people taking it in a different direction." Is that the most leading question ever asked in the history of a congressional hearing? Probably. And the whole interview goes on like this. Keep in mind, Ray Epps is one of the only people caught on camera that day encouraging others to break the law. He's one of the only ones. And yet he's never been charged. And the January 6th committee was on his side. Why was the committee and its members working so hard to help Ray Epps? Now, in his interview with the committee, Ray Epps said he didn't work for law enforcement. Law enforcement, in a very specifically worded answer, clearly thought through ahead of time. The question is, did Ray Epps work or have any contact with any government agency? Did he talk about January 6th before it happened with any employee of the U.S. government? We don't know. We do know that 2 years after January 6th, long after an awful lot of other people have gone to jail for walking around the Capitol building, Ray Epps is still a free man. He's never been charged, much less imprisoned in solitary confinement like so many others. Why is that? Well, let's just stop lying. At this point, it's pretty obvious why that is. But of course, they're still lying about it. Julie Kelly is one of the very few reporters in America who has covered this story honestly since the first day. She is the author of the book January 6th, and we are honored to have her join us tonight. Julie Kelly, thank you so much for coming on. Can you just give us a couple, since you are the human encyclopedia on January 6th, I would say, a repository of all the information. I mean, just give us a very quick overview of the scale of the law enforcement response to what happened 2 years ago today.
So, Tucker, what we have now are almost 1,000 criminal defendants related to their involvement in January 6th. What the FBI and Department of Justice now is warning is that figure will double by the time that they're done. They believe that they have 2,000 perpetrators of the alleged insurrection, and they are going to continue this manhunt for Trump supporters into this year. And so you had the FBI official this week, the new head of the Washington, D.C. field office, say this investigation will go on for years. So what is this about? This is not about making sure that people who really committed violence, a small handful that day, are brought to justice. This is to perpetuate Joe Biden and the Department of Justice and FBI's phony narrative that domestic terrorists, i.e. Trump supporters, pose a grave threat to this country. It's really shameful. It has resulted in the destruction of so many innocent lives and their families. The FBI continues to arrest people almost every week. And I believe right now we have at least 100 people incarcerated behind bars, either under pretrial detention or serving out excessive prison sentences for either plea deals or being convicted by a jury in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, while rapists go free and 7 million foreign nationals flood into our country. I have to say, since you're in contact with an awful lot of people who've been swept up in this and who are also researching it, at this point, does any honest person believe that the feds were all over this? I mean, parts of this were clearly influenced by federal agencies. I mean, that's not a conspiracy theory, is it?
Well, it's not. And that's why I think it's interesting, Tucker, that in an 845-page investigative report by the January 6th committee, Christopher Wray's name is not mentioned a single time. They didn't even interview FBI Director Christopher Wray. Now, why is that? They also didn't interview Stephen D'Antuono, the newly retired head of the Washington field office, who was in charge of FBI agents, informants, et cetera, assets on January 6, 2021.
I mean, what we made a documentary on this a year ago, as you know, and you helped us with it. And we were attacked widely by a lot of Republicans, too, for mentioning the obvious, which is the feds had a hand in this. Will we ever know the truth, do you think?
We have to. We now know for a fact, Tucker, because of these trials, that there were informants months before January 6th run into the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, at least 8 informants in the Proud Boys months before January 6th. What were they doing? We have to find out.
I think we do. Julie Kelly, thank you for your relentless, dogged reporting on this. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tucker.
So the one person we know for a fact was murdered, killed without justification on January 6th, 2021, was Ashley Babbitt, an unarmed 14-year military veteran. And she's the one person whose name was not mentioned during any of the official January 6th memorials. Instead, Ashley Babbitt's mother, Mickey Whithoft, was arrested today by the Capitol Police. She was apparently at the Capitol to memorialize her daughter's death. Police say she was jaywalking, so they put her in handcuffs. Hard to believe, but here's the footage.
You murdered her inside the Capitol, now you're going to arrest her?
So her daughter was shot to death, unarmed, with no stated justification by an officer who shouldn't have been on the force with a documented history of the reckless use of firearms, and it's the mother who gets arrested for jaywalking at a memorial for her own daughter. You wonder how much more of this the country can take. Aaron Babbitt has suffered for 2 years because of it. Of course, he is the husband of Ashley Babbitt, and we are happy to have him join us tonight. Aaron, thank you so much for coming on. I have to ask you about the arrest of your mother-in-law by the same police force that killed your wife.
Yeah, I just saw that video for the first time when I was coming into the studio. My phone was blowing up. A little backstory on that. Mickey's actually been in D.C. since the beginning of August. She's been there every day, living in that area, sitting outside the jail at night and protesting outside the Capitol. So I'm not going to say it's a coincidence. She was finally arrested on January 6th, but that doesn't really smell right.
Well, it's beyond on the two-year anniversary of her daughter's killing. It's beyond. And I've asked you this before, but I have to ask you again. Has anyone in elected office reached out to take your side, to take up your case, to get justice for your wife who was killed without justification that day?
It's still the same. Troy Knowles, Louis Gohmert, but he's out now. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz. I'm sure there's a couple other, Paul Gosar. There's a couple other ones, but it's still that very small percentage.
Looking back 2 years to the day after her killing, what do you make of it? How would you sum up this experience?
I mean, for me personally, I've learned over these last 2 years, it's never going to get easier losing her. It just gets a little bit different every day. And I'm just in full force mode of continuing my fight for Ashley, and that's what I will continue to do.
Well, I hope you prevail. You can't just shoot people and then move on. And I hope you won't let them. Aaron Babbitt, thank you.
Thank you, Tucker.
So earlier this week, as Kevin McCarthy struggled to win over recalcitrant Republicans and support him to become the next Speaker of the House, we offered up a suggestion for what McCarthy could do, an important reform. And it looks like McCarthy, who is apparently on his way to becoming Speaker, has taken up that idea. We'll speak to a member of Congress who will be quarterbacking that for him. Plus, there is a war going on in our neighbor to the south in Mexico, a hot war. People are trying to shoot down airplanes. This has not gotten a lot of coverage. It needs a lot of coverage, and it suggests big changes for us. When you have a war on your border, things are different. We'll get the very latest on that next.
This is a Fox News Alert. I'm Trace Gallagher, live in Los Angeles. The battle for House Speaker could come to an end later tonight. The House is set to reconvene less than 2 hours from now. Earlier today, 15 of the 20 conservative holdouts threw their support behind GOP leader Kevin McCarthy. During the 12th and 13th rounds of balloting, McCarthy needs 218 votes to become Speaker if all congressmen are present. They're still short of that majority, but optimism is building among Republicans. Watch.
Negotiations are going well. They're very confident that we're going to get two of the six to, at the very least, switch to present. But regardless, we should be in the area tonight to where we finally have a Speaker of the House and we can finally get to work on that.
Republicans have a slim majority of 222 lawmakers, so McCarthy can leave only four GOP minds unchanged. This is the longest stretch of Speaker votes since 1859, when 44 votes were held. Members of the 218 Congress have also not been sworn in yet, since that can't happen until a Speaker is elected. Keep us in mind. We will break in when news breaks out. Stay with Fox News Channel as we continue to follow tonight's events on Capitol Hill. The House is set to reconvene at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. here in California. I'll see you back here on Fox News at night. Now back to Tucker Carlson.
So we spent all week telling you about the fight on Capitol Hill over who's going to be the next Speaker of the House. Of course, at the beginning, the presumption was Kevin McCarthy was going to get the job, and then a group of his colleagues stood up and said, not so fast, and for a couple of days, they successfully held him off. Well, during that period, Kevin McCarthy decided to make some changes in the way he's going to administer the House and its priorities, and one of them is something that we've been talking about and certainly thinking about for quite some time, which is the creation of a committee modeled after the famous Frank Church Committee of the 1970s that will look a lot more closely at the influence of the FBI and the various intel agencies on domestic politics. They're not allowed to interfere in domestic politics. They clearly have been, and maybe Congress could get to the bottom of that. In fact, they're the only ones who can. Well, Kevin McCarthy's going to do that. Looks like he's going to be Speaker. And his plan, we have just learned, is to appoint really one of the most honest and dogged members of Congress, we'll just say it, Thomas Massie of Kentucky, to head that committee, the new church committee run by Congressman Thomas Massie, who, by the way, joins us now to announce it. Congressman, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Tucker. It looks like I'll probably be on that committee, but I can't say that I will run it. I will say that, you know, while we've seen this drama unplay on the House floor behind the scenes, along with those people who withheld their vote for Kevin McCarthy until they got the transformational changes in the House and the way the House works, we were working with to make sure that this church committee, a suggestion that you've had, and thank you for suggesting that I should be on it. I don't know if you're clairvoyant or just made the future happen, but it's happening. We were making sure that this committee wasn't going to be fenced in, that it wasn't just going to be a show committee. We wanted to make sure that we have full jurisdiction, that if we stumble onto something at another three-letter agency, that they don't say, whoa, that's out of your jurisdiction. Or if we find out there's more than a violation of the First Amendment right, if there are other civil rights that are being violated, we've secured a guarantee that we can go wherever the evidence leads us.
So everyone who's attempted this, and few have attempted it, but Frank Church certainly attempted it, and the Congress attempted it again in 1976 with their Special Committee on Assassinations. Those committees bumped right headlong into a wall of secrecy, and it drove a lot of them, those members, kind of crazy. Are you prepared for this honestly awesome task?
I think we are, and we've been laying the groundwork for that. Dan Bishop, my colleague from North Carolina, and Jim Jordan, we've been talking to the Intel Committee, which has the authority to get all of that information. By the way, a lot of this is going to play out down in the SCIF. You're going to have to trust the people that are put on this committee. And I'll tell you what, if there's something fishy going on, I'll come out of the SCIF and tell you. But a lot of it will be behind closed doors. There'll be classified information. But if we find anything illegal or unconstitutional, we will bring it forward.
Well, in your specific case, I believe you. And I'm so grateful that you're doing this. And I really hope that if you find anything like that, to the extent you can tell us about it, you will. Thomas Massie of Kentucky, thank you.
Thank you, Tucker.
So Congress is continuing to send billions a month to Ukraine because that war is more important than any other war. But actually, there is a new war that really will affect Americans, and it's in Mexico. The Mexican Defense Forces, the Mexican Army, now battling the Sinaloa cartel in response to the arrest of the son of El Chapo. And as of tonight, the Mexican Defense Forces appear to be losing. Watch.
Thank you.
probably should have identified it. The clip you saw of people cowering in the commercial airliner, that plane was being shot at by a 50 cal from the drug cartels. So it's a war. Now, Biden is visiting the border this weekend. He has no plan to deal with any of this, but it will affect us. How could it not? Retired U.S. Army Colonel Doug McGregor has been following this for months now. He joins us tonight. Doug, thanks so much for coming on. This, it would seem if a war breaks out in a country with whom you share this enormously long border, that there would be coverage of it. There hasn't been. Why?
Well, we're lucky to get this glimpse. The media simply doesn't bother to cover it. But we really need to understand what this war is about. In 2020, we arrested the Mexican Minister of Defense, a general named Cienfuegos, in California, on charges associated with drug trafficking, human trafficking, and a whole list of crimes. Ultimately, we turned him over to the president of Mexico, President Obrador, who promptly released him, and we dropped the charges. Now, one of the reasons we dropped the charges is that we were promised more cooperation, but it hasn't been forthcoming. And so what we're really seeing here is not an effort to enforce the law, not an effort to do anything good. It's a fight between a cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, and the Mexican army. They're fighting for turf, they're fighting for cash, they're fighting for influence inside Mexico. They want the son of El Chapo's, presumably, so they can give it to the president of Mexico and he can create the illusion that by turning him over to us, that there is cooperation with Mexico. Tucker, there's no cooperation with Mexico. And President Obrador is irrelevant. He does not run the country. He's a mouthpiece for the drug cartels.
So if the president of Mexico is a mouthpiece for the drug cartels and the government of Mexico has allowed millions of foreign nationals to stream over its territory into our country, sure, along with fentanyl that's killed hundreds of thousands of people in this country, why is Mexico not our main enemy?
Well, that's a good point, because Mexico right now and Central America writ large, because of the criminality, is an existential threat to us. It's the only truly existential threat to the country. And remember, they reach into the United States, all of your major cities. There are networks there that reach back into Mexico. That's why they're powerful, and that's a war that will eventually have to be fought, because at some point, we will shut down the border because things will have gotten that bad. When we do that, we will immediately be at war with the drug cartels because we've cut off their income, and we're going to have to fight inside the United States as well as on our border. And that's going to demand the United States Army, because our Border Patrol is not nearly as well equipped. They're outgunned, outperformed in every sense, every category of military power by the cartels. What you saw is a good demonstration of just how powerful those cartels are.
So you're saying we could see scenes like this in our country?
Absolutely. It's inevitable.
So the last time a president suggested deploying the U.S. military to the border, the Pentagon scoffed at him, I think unconstitutionally, yeah, but they did. Do you think the Pentagon would be willing to fight the drug cartels? They seem to have they issue their own orders at this point, it seems.
Well, the fact that you're raising the question is a sad and tragic comment on the state, yeah, of civil-military relations, that we have people at the top of the military establishment who pick and choose from a menu of tasks and decide what they will or won't do, presumably because there's lots of money in the Ukraine war and there's not money for them in the Mexican war. And bear in mind that Ukraine and Mexico are just about equally corrupt. The difference is that right now they're killing more people in Ukraine, but the murder rate in Mexico is one of the highest in the world, about 136 out of every 100,000. So it leads most of the world in murder. So it's not that far off. It wouldn't take much to catch up with Ukraine. But as you point out, Ukraine means a lot of money for a lot of people in Washington. Shutting down the border, stopping the influx of illegals, stopping the human trafficking, and going after the drug cartels doesn't really make anybody money.
Just last question, not to be pedantic, but doesn't ignoring or disobeying an order from a president, doesn't that constitute a felony? Isn't that a crime? They're not allowed to do that, are they?
Yes. It is essentially on par with a criminal act. But you've got a chairman who decided to call the leadership of the Chinese military and tell them that, don't worry, if we attack you, we'll let you know in advance.
Why didn't he go to jail for that?
Why is he still holding his office? Why is he still a four-star general? I mean, he's not alone. When's the last time we held anybody in the military accountable for anything?
Sad. Doug McGregor, thank you.
Sure.
One of the first things Biden did after becoming president was cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, in the middle of an energy crisis, the administration is admitting, to some extent, that was a disastrous decision. Details next. So what happens when you change the population of a country virtually overnight through immigration, legal and illegal? Well, in some places, people who were born here no longer feel welcome here. That's probably inevitable, and it's happening a lot. Cheyenne Kenny of Turning Point just did some reporting on the effects of this. On December 30th, she went to her local DMV office in Oakland, California. That's an American city in an American state. And when she arrived, she found that the DMV was out of English language driver's manuals and had been for, quote, about a month.
We're at the DMV right now. We're looking for a driver's handbook in English. As you can see, there's none in English. Vietnamese, Spanish, Japanese, but absolutely none in English. So we're going to go talk with one of the workers and see if they have some in the back.
I was wondering if you had any driver's handbooks.
For English? No, we don't.
No, we don't have it in English here. It's just America. Don't worry. Cheyenne Kenny is the president of the Turning Point Oakland Activism Hub, and she joins us tonight. Cheyenne, thank you so much for coming on. So if, I mean, just to ask the obvious question, if you don't have an English language driver's manual, then people who speak English can't study for the driving test. Is that right?
Exactly, Tucker. I don't know how we're going to know how to drive if we can't even study the manual.
I was really struck by this video, and thank you so much for making it, because it's small things like this that really tell you what's happening to the country. But I was struck by the total lack of sympathy that you got from the woman at the DMV. And she didn't seem that interested in the fact you couldn't read a driver's manual in your own country at all.
No, she did not care. And in fact, she told me to stop filming. She didn't seem like she didn't really want people to know there was no handbooks in English anymore. This is a public place. We should be allowed to film and talk about this. Especially because we're all trying to learn to drive and we can't because we can't read the manuals.
Well, of course, and it's your country and this is the DMV. These people work for you. And last question, I just want to make sure this is exactly correct factually. They didn't have an English language driver's manual for over a month in the purportedly richest state in the country. They just couldn't get around to printing it or something?
A whole month, an entire month. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Cheyenne Kenny, I appreciate your coming on and telling that story and for documenting it for us.
Thank you, Tucker.
Thank you. So one of the first things that Joe Biden did after he got elected was to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. In late December, the Department of Energy quietly admitted that this was a complete disaster for the United States of America. The Department of Energy determined in a report that the Keystone XL project would have created up to 59,000 jobs, real jobs too, not fake jobs like university administrators, but people who do stuff. It would also have had a positive economic impact of up to $9 billion. Alex Epstein is the author of Fossil Future and really one of the world's experts on energy. He joins us to assess this. Alex, thanks so much for coming on. So, admitting what I think you were saying at the time, which is don't do this. This is a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I looked into the details of the report, and it's the minimum possible admission they could make. I mean, this thing, this cancellation of Keystone has been an absolute disaster. Number one, it made good on Biden's promise. I guarantee you we're going to end fossil fuel. And so it was really the beginning of a reign of terror on the fossil fuel industry that has suppressed investment, production, refining, right, transportation. And they were required by law to make this report, but it's such a weaselly report. It tries to get away with saying there's nothing significant. It even pretends that the lack of heavy oil from Canada isn't a problem, even though it's clearly been a disaster that's caused us to beg to Venezuela. And it does that by, instead of addressing reality, it cites an Obama 2011 prediction saying it wouldn't be a problem. That's like ignoring the 2008 housing crisis by citing a 2005 prediction that it wouldn't be a problem. So this is really just another denial of reality by an administration that wants to deny that its anti-fossil fuel policies have been an absolute disaster here and around the world.
So the admission is itself a whitewash. I mean, it's just so perfect. So if you just...
It's a total whitewash.
That's just unbelievable. Alex Epstein, I hope that we see you again soon. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Tucker.
So a lot of people are drug addicts. Their preferred drug is fentanyl. Some people are publicity addicts. They just can't get enough. If you're not talking about them, they can barely breathe. That would include Prince Harry and the fake Duchess from L.A. They'd like more attention, so they're trashing the royal family yet again. Prince Harry has made a bunch of new allegations, so we feel a little guilty repeating, but they're so over the top that we can't control ourselves, and so we'll tell you what they are after the break. Well, it looks like Prince Harry and that woman from L.A. that he married are running out of money. How do we know that? Because they're still talking about themselves, selling the most boring little details from their boring little lives for more money. So to that end, Prince Harry has just resorted to telling us even more about a dramatic physical altercation he had with his brother, which wasn't actually that dramatic. Quote, he set down the water, called me another name, and then came at me, he says in his new book. Yeah. Huh? But for some reason, a lot of media outlets in this country are deeply invested in the details of this boring man's boring life. Here's Good Morning America, for example.
There's a quote in his book where you refer to your brother as your beloved brother and arch nemesis. Strong words. What did you mean by that?
There has always been this competition between us, weirdly. I think it really plays into, or is played by, the heir spare.
Oh, so two brothers who had tension between them. Breaking news on Good Morning America. But if you're from Great Britain, and these are the people who are supposedly, technically, the head of state of your country, what do you make of all of this, this embarrassing spectacle? Well, we thought it was time to check in with Father Calvin Robinson, who's an Anglican deacon from that country, who joins us tonight to assess. Father, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, how is this going over in your country?
Tucker, first of all, Happy New Year. How is it going over? I think we're all sick and tired of Harry and Meghan whining and moaning and going on and on. Well, most of us are anyway. You know, at first, when I first saw these headlines, I thought, okay, this is annoying, this is frustrating. They're being disparaging about the monarchy again, which of course is family to them, but to us it's an institution at the very fabric of our nation. But I'm past frustration. I actually feel sorry for Harry now. He's using really juvenile language. He seems quite immature, to be honest. I don't know any other grown man that talks about their private parts as their todger. You know, he talks about mounting a woman. And it's the kind of conversation I expect to hear in a primary school. Just in that clip you just showed, he talks about his brother as his arch nemesis. How many adults have an arch nemesis? He seems to live in a fantasy world. You know, in the excerpts, we saw that Meghan was singing to seals, and Harry said, she's magical because the seals sang back. I'm like, these people are delusional. This is not good. They need to seek help. They need to stop talking to the press, stop airing their dirty laundry, and actually get some professional medical help.
I wonder, I mean, you're obviously a man of the cloth. What does it do to your soul if you never stop talking about yourself?
Exactly. It's the inner narcissism. It's not good. It eats away at you. And it's not just talking about yourself. It's the fact that they don't seem to take any agency for themselves either. There's no personal responsibility. You know, in a few of these excerpts, we've seen that Harry says, oh, actually, it was Will and Kate who made me wear that Nazi uniform. And you're thinking, you're a grown adult. You don't have to wear a Nazi uniform to a fancy dress party if you don't find it funny. You clearly chose to do so. Don't blame everyone else. And the same, you know, he goes on to say that he had this altercation with his brother. And this is a trained army serviceman who's saying, I had a fight with my brother. I had to go seek therapy for that. It's like, first of all, you are a killer. You're talking about how many people you've killed in service, which, of course, is uncouth. No one talks about how many people they killed in service. But then on the other hand of the argument, you're saying, oh, I had an argument with my brother and I had to go and get therapy about it. None of it seems to add up. It's not balanced. He does need prayer. I think he needs all of our prayer. They both do. And they need something more professional, too.
Yeah. I mean, no, I think, and you make a fair point that no one can make you wear a Nazi uniform to a dinner party. You did that. It's unbelievable. Father Calvin Robinson of the United Kingdom, thank you so much.
God God
bless. We'll be right back. And with that, another drama-packed week in American life and politics comes to an end, or at least our participation in it. We hope you have the best weekend with the ones you love, and we will see you on Monday.